What's the difference between a riot and an uprising? Your answer might have something to do with your perspective on the violence. Today's guest looks at events at Attica State Prison in 1971 and draws a direct connection to the challenges America faces in its criminal justice system today. She's Heather Ann Thompson this week on Story in the Public Square. Welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host G. Wayne Miller from the Providence Journal. Every week, we try to make sense of the narrative shaping public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Heather Ann Thompson, who is also a professor of history at the University of Michigan. Heather, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here.
So your Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy, is a stunning work. So congratulations.
Thank you.
We want to talk about it and the issues that it raises about contemporary America. But first, help us set the stage. Tell our audience, you know, what is Attica and what were the conditions in the prison like prior to the uprising?
Well, so the Attica Prison is a prison in a very small town in upstate New York. It is still an active prison today, maximum security facility. And today, like in 1971, which is when the prison will erupt, conditions were terrible. They remain terrible. They were terrible in 1971. The difference was that in 1971, men who were being fed on 63 cents a day, given a square of toilet paper a day, had really tried to better their conditions by writing letters and trying to get help. And when that doesn't work, there is an absolute eruption, and that is going to lead to one of the most really important prisoner rights, human rights protests in American history.
And it's triggered by the conditions in the prison.
Absolutely. You know, these are 2,400 men crammed into this facility with very poor conditions, and really wanted just basic human rights. Didn't want to get out. Didn't want to really want more than what we would have just as human beings.
So give us a visual image of what that prison looked like at that time, and what was it made out of, how big were the cells, all of that.
Well, this is a huge institution that was actually built during the Depression, and this institution looked in 1971 just as it did in the 30s, incidentally, as it does today. It's a fortress, 30-foot walls, cement walls, four different exercise yards, and just really crammed over capacity with largely black and brown men from the New York City area, from the inner cities of Buffalo, Rochester, New York, and folks that were, you know, this is the end of Vietnam. These are folks returning from Vietnam, a lot of folks with drug addictions, you know, and largely poor people who had ended up in the system because they had not had good representation, serving, you know, hard time, but there was parole violators in there as well.
So what took place during the uprising?
Well, ultimately, the uprising happens quite by happenstance. A very poor decision on the part of prison management leads to this chaotic moment. A gate opens. But out of that chaotic riot comes a really remarkable struggle where the men move to one yard. They bring in observers to help them negotiate with the state. They elect representatives to speak for them out of each cell block. And they come up with a list of demands of the state of New York. Again, very basic human rights demands. And they have taken state hostages, employees hostage, hoping that that will keep the negotiations going, and hoping that by protecting the hostages, this will allow them to negotiate a peaceful settlement.
And that's not what happened, though.
No, unfortunately, despite the fact that negotiations were going very well, despite the fact that there were top observers from, you know, all over the state of New York begging the governor at the time, Nelson Rockefeller, to make sure this ended peacefully, the governor decided to enter the prison with force, sending in hundreds of state troopers who had been there for that same 4 days of negotiations around the clock. They'd been on the outside accumulating weapons and passing out weapons that they didn't even know how to use, angry, incidentally, because the FBI was there rumor-mongering. And that is who he sent in. And everyone told him it was going to be a massacre, and that's exactly what it was.
What kind of rumors were being spread?
Well, the FBI, I later discovered, was circulating the idea that the prisoners inside were forcing, for example, the hostages to stand at attention, and if they didn't, they would be shot to death or killed in some other fashion. Incidentally, the prisoners don't have any guns, neither do the corrections officers inside. And so if you're a police officer on the outside, you know, you're itching to get in. Which is why the observers were begging the governor, come to Attica, tell them that they can surrender and not be harmed. But he was not interested in doing that.
Who was the governor at that time?
Governor Nelson Rockefeller in New York, you know, known as a quite liberal Republican.
Yes, yes.
But this is 1971, and the tide is turning. He very much wants to be the president. Nixon's in the White House. This is becoming a very staunch law and order moment. And I think Attica really becomes his line in the sand. He's not going to budge when it comes to negotiating with prisoners.
So this was page one headlines and leading the news for quite a while.
The media was there. They were inside of the facility.
Inside the prison.
They were inside. They were reporting this. And really importantly, the American people were quite sympathetic to the folks on the inside. This is a moment when we thought, you know, maybe civil rights, you know, was a good thing, that human rights mattered even inside of prisons. But the way that this story is told after the uprising is taken by force is going to change everything.
Well, so let's talk about that, because this is actually a really interesting example of the power of story in American public life. So your scholarship and you're an accomplished historian has revealed a story that's different from the story that was told in the immediate aftermath by authorities about what had transpired both in the raid and in the uprising itself. What's the record that you're correcting, if we, you know,
I should first say that the only reason why I was able to write the book was because the survivors had insisted for decades on still telling their stories, and also I had the pure luck of coming across some key documents that indicated what had really happened. But the state told us that when they retook the prison, the reason why hostages had been killed was that the prisoners had killed them. And this story went out on the front page of the New York Times and the LA Times and the AP newspapers all across America.
And the world, probably.
And the world. And it was simply not true. And that lie led not only to the men inside being tortured brutally for days and weeks and months. These are men, incidentally, who have been, you know, 128 of them shot so severely, some of them 6-7 bullet wounds, forced to strip, crawl across the shattered glass in the prison, and literally tortured. But the American people don't hear any of this. They hear that the prisoners inside were not really civil rights activists or human rights concerned. They were barbarians. They were animals.
Wow, that's amazing. So how did you come to write this book? There have been other books. It was certainly in the news in the early 70s.
Well, it's an interesting story. I was by training a civil rights, an urban historian, a civil rights historian, a labor historian, and I had heard, you know, about Attica. I think it was kind of in our kind of common lore. We sort of knew about it. But I was interested in it because it was a civil rights protest behind bars. And I thought, well, that's different. That's interesting. What was going on? Having no idea that it was going to be a 13-year journey to figure out where the records were, to uncover the story, and frankly, to recognize that this prison issue, this issue of prisons, was much, much bigger than Attica, that in fact it is the crisis of the day. And I didn't know any of this, really. I was very naive about how important prisons were in our society when I began the book.
You said you talked to survivors.
Mm-hmm.
give us a glimpse of who they are, how old they might be, and was it not simply prisoners, but other people who were there, who,
yes,
who survived?
Yes, I was determined to talk. Well, first of all, you know, over 13 years, you come to know many people who were touched by Attica, the lawyers, the judges, the people who tried to settle it, some of the observers, Tom Wicker for the New York Times, for example, I was able to talk to before he passed away, but also the prisoners who had endured that terrible retaking and had been tortured. The guards, remember that the guards have also been killed and their families have also been traumatized. And I came to know some of the guard families and to really understand that this was a case where state officials had no regard for either their own state employees or the people that they kept in the prisons.
So these people must be of advanced age by now, or
well, some
many
are.
Of them.
So some of them are in, say, their 70s. Some
okay.
of the prisoners and guards. One of the greatest fighters for justice in this story is this daughter of a slain correction officer. I came to know her, so she's more my age. But yes, you know, several people passed away before I was able to finish this book, and that's very heartbreaking because I think it would have given them. Perhaps some measure of peace, because people lived for decades with the guilt that somehow they should have stopped this, or somehow they should have made it go away, not understanding that this was a plan at the highest levels, not just to retake the prison with force, but to deliberately cover up what had happened for the next 40 years. Notably, no member of law enforcement was ever indicted for what happened at Attica, despite the fact that 39 men were shot to death and 128 shot severely and the rest tortured for, again, months.
So talk to us for a moment about the importance of language. So when there's a violent disturbance in a prison, we typically hear of it termed a prison riot. Mm-hmm. You call this an uprising.
Right.
Talk to us about the difference there.
Well, I think those words are critically important. In most recent news, 2 weeks ago, we had an alleged riot in South Carolina prisons. I was immediately put a little bit on edge when I heard that term, because it connotes people that just lose their minds for no reason, destroy property for no reason, attack each other or guards for no reason. And the thing about understanding the way our prison system works is you understand that they are run so poorly, the human rights abuses are so rampant, that this is never just about people acting out for no reason. And in the case of Attica, there was clearly articulated attempts to make prison conditions better. So it was a rebellion. It was not just some chaotic upheaval of violent men.
So this is a wonderful work about an incident, a moment in American history, but it has a lot of relevance for today. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot. Talk about that.
Well, you know, I am very grateful that the story that the men have been trying to tell for so long and their families have been trying to tell for so long is seen as relevant today. I think it is. I mean, today we have more people locked up than any other country on the planet, longer sentences served than at any other time in American history. And I would suggest that's because we really misunderstood. We got the history of Attica wrong. We didn't do it because we were willful about it. We were told an incorrect story about Attica, and we didn't learn that prisons needed to be made more human. Somehow we were made to feel that they needed to become more punitive, that we needed to be less humane. And that lesson has cost us dearly. We have terrible prison conditions today, children serving life sentences, countless hours being served in solitary confinement. And it doesn't make us safer, and it doesn't make our communities better. In fact, it makes everything worse. So I think we need to look back and see, how did we make this terribly wrong turn? And Attica's ground zero, I think, for that.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. You can find us four times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a team of world-class professionals at Rhode Island PBS, and we're grateful for all they do. I'm Jim Lutis, Executive Director of the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in historic Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, I'm at J.M. Lutis. My friend and co-host is G. Wayne Miller, an award-winning reporter with the Providence Journal. Wayne is also the author of 17 books. You can catch up with him on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller, all one word. And our guest this week is Heather Ann Thompson, an historian at the University of Michigan who in 2017 won both the Pulitzer Prize and the Bancroft Prize for her book, Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. You can find her on Twitter, too, at HTHOMPSN, H. Thompson without the O. Am I right in thinking that there's a link, too, between, for lack of a better term, the politicization of criminal justice? So you think about the rise of elected sheriffs, elected prosecutors, elected judges, who quite often talk about they're going to get tough on crime, let alone governors and mayors and presidents. Is it the politicization from top to bottom of the criminal justice system a part of this?
It's not just a part of it. It is central to it. We tend to think of the prison system as being a reflection of crime. And for logical reasons, you know, people get arrested, they go to jail, presumably because they did something wrong. But if you look over the broad history of the United States, every moment when we've had a major uptick of incarceration, and particularly racialized incarceration, which is really what's happened in the last 40 years, it is not in response to crime, it is in response to urban upheaval. It is in response to civil rights. It is in response to challenges to the social order. And I know that some listeners and viewers will think, really? Are you kidding me? But it is well, well documented that we now, for example, have the lowest crime rate ever, the highest prison rate, but they're disaggregated. You know, if you trace out the crime rate, it goes up and down. The prison rate has gone nothing but up. And we need to think about these things as political institutions. The laws are what lead to incarceration. People's drug addiction rates have remained remarkably stable over American history. You know, the crime rate waxes and wanes. So yes, politics are what this is all about. But that's good news, actually, because it means that this is a bad policy. Numerous bad policies that led to the war on drugs and war on crime. And we chose them, but that also means that we can unchoose them.
Fix them.
So what continues to sustain this narrative held and believed and espoused by many people that prisons are there because we have a lot of criminals, a lot of bad guys, and a few bad girls that need to be locked up to make us safe? What sustains that? I mean, you've really ripped that to shreds correctly and appropriately and accurately. But some people still, it's like,
well, it's storytelling.
This is what we got to do.
I mean, it is the sort of the heart of what we're doing here today. When you tell stories incorrectly or you tell stories in self-serving fashion, for example, if you're the storyteller but you are investing a lot of money in prisons, if you're a storyteller about prisons but you're actually the person who is selling goods to prisons, you have a vested interest in them. And if you're a politician seeking to get elected and you know that fear is one of the greatest ways to make people choose you if you're going to make them feel safe. I mean, these are vested interests, stories that are not correct, but serve purposes. And so I hope that the Attica story and the story not just of Attica, but all of the people who have now come out of this system, you know, we have nearly 100 million Americans now with a criminal justice record, with a criminal record.
How many is that?
Almost 100 million.
Oh, my
and
that's incredible.
What that population of 320 million.
Oh, well, we still, I mean, on this given day, we have more than 7.5 million Americans under correctional control. It is a staggering number. But what that means is that it's very important that all of those people tell their stories. They are. And they are disabusing us of the notion that there's equal justice under the law. And the truth is, we know this, right? We know that if it were true that everyone who did the crime did the time, we'd have 10 million people in prison, perhaps more. The reality is we only police some people, and the majority of people in prison are there because they're poor, because they are drug addicted, and because they've been heavily policed in ways that, for example, upper middle class white kids are not. And that's just true.
These are people who do not have the same voice that others might have.
Absolutely.
In terms of telling that, not only telling that story, but getting that story to a larger audience, meaning the entire nation. These are people who are not benefiting from economic circumstances, who are discriminated against because of race and so forth.
Correct? Even worse, Yes, and even worse, mass incarceration has this way of ensuring its own survival, because everyone who's been incarcerated for a felony, first of all, everyone in prison can't vote. And in multiple states, if you've been ever incarcerated for a felony, which doesn't mean you're necessarily a bad person, right? Felonies have been used widely and loosely for the last 40 years. You can't vote in many states. So it literally means that they don't have a voice. It means the people most impacted by this do not have a political voice to change the laws that were unjust to begin with. So it's really, really insidious, and it's one that we need to know about, as it has distorted our democracy. And so as citizens, whether we know someone on the inside or not, this should concern us as Americans.
So you said previously in another interview that, quote, we created mass incarceration with bipartisan will.
Absolutely.
So this is not a left-right, Democrat-Republican nope. thing. Explain that for us.
Well, you know, we begin the war on crime in the Johnson administration when he creates the apparatus for it with the Law Enforcement Assistant Administration. But, you know, every administration since then has added to it. You know, everyone from Reagan to Clinton. I mean, there's nobody whose hands are clean here. And likewise, everybody's been a victim from it. This is not just about prisoners who've been a victim. It's not just about the family members of poor people. You know, law enforcement has been victimized by this. This is a terrible job to be sent out day in and day out to police low-level drugs. It leads to terrible outcomes. It has led to law enforcement deaths, correction officer deaths, and citizen deaths at records that are just alarming. And it's a failed policy for everybody, and everybody played a role in bringing it on board.
So why, so if with all that being stated, why are we locked into this paradigm? Why are we not able to, you know, I listen to the political rhetoric right now and I don't hear anybody
right.
talking about prisoners' rights, right? I hear people talking about, you know, there's some distinction now with opioid versus crack cocaine 30 years ago, mm-hmm. but I don't hear anybody talking about that kind of reform in the criminal justice system.
Well, unfortunately, the politicians tend to come from the class of people who are least policed and least incarcerated, or actually, fortunately for them.
Yeah.
But that means that they don't necessarily identify or know or feel empathy for the people whom this has impacted most. But it's also getting back to the earlier point. You know, it's this extraordinary big business. It, you know, from everything from tampons to tasers to telephones is a commodity that is sold to a captive audience. Employers use prison labor. I mean, places like, you know, Wisconsin was able to get rid of unionized janitors by using prison labor. We were able to clean up after the BP oil spill with prison laborers. We were able to fight fires in California just this year with prison labor.
And the inmates collect debris on the side.
That's
roads,
right.
they make
right.
license plates and so
That's
forth.
Right. So there are vested interests in this, but we are citizens who care about the democracy. We are citizens who care about our fellow citizens, and for all of those reasons, it is through storytelling that we at least lay bare what is happening here. And it is not about public safety, because in fact, mass incarceration escalates violence in heavily incarcerated communities. It does not make us safer.
So there's another element to this, and that is not simply prisoners' rights and within prisons. Mm-hmm. That element, and there are experts in the criminal justice system and outside who say diversion programs can help, better mental health programs can help, better rehabilitation, better options mm-hmm. for when people are discharged or released and put mm-hmm. on a bus and good luck. Why doesn't that get more traction? I mean, these are credible people
yeah.
in and out of the criminal justice system who say, this is a better way. Why yeah. not?
Well, it is one of these extraordinary moments when not only are the people that are laying bare the evidence not necessarily the ones who folks listen to, either voters or politicians, but it's also the case that these solutions, these answers, give us some hope, because we hope that, in fact, by seeing that they work, eventually people will recognize that they are more cost effective, they are more humane. And again, it's a battle for narratives. Think about it this way. Most prisons, the majority of prisons, are public. Only about 7% are private. And that means that we actually pay for and are the stewards of all of these institutions we've just been talking about. And they have nearly an 80% failure rate by their own data, which is recidivism. So why do we not raise questions? And one of the reasons is we have no laws that help with transparency. We don't know what goes on behind bars, right? They're far, far away. They're out of sight, out of mind. And but I would imagine that if our schools were failing at the rate of 80%, citizens would say, we don't want those schools anymore, right? So we just need to, you know, it's about education, I think.
So I'm curious. So you are an accomplished historian. In addition to the Pulitzer, you also won the Bancroft Prize. But you engage your the historical record, but in the and you bring it to popular audiences through a variety of different means. To engage on these public issues. Is there a special insight you bring to bear as a historian looking at these issues?
You know, I hope so. I do think that there are folks that wonder, you know, how could you be an academic and be a historian and still weigh in on debates that are very politically charged, very contemporary. But the thing is at bottom, I am a historian, which means that I start with the record. The record takes you where it takes you. The evidence takes you where it takes you. And I think that once it takes you so unequivocally to a place that only adds up to one thing, which is that this is not working and that the costs of it are enormous for multiple segments of our society, to not then try to share that and try to, you know, let people who might not be in my classroom know about it. I mean, I think that's a responsibility, but it always comes from the research, from the scholarship. It's not my opinion, it's not my wish for society or my hope, but I mean, it really does come from the work.
Well, it is a remarkable body of work, and
thank
Heather
you.
Thompson, we are so grateful for you for joining for us. She's Heather Ann Thompson. The book is Blood in the Water, The Attica Prison Uprising of 1971 and Its Legacy. You should check it out. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about storing the public square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can always visit pellcenter.org, where you can catch up on previous episodes. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us again next time for more Storing the Public Square.